Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 39, Perspective and Perception.
In this episode, we're going to look at the ways that physical handicaps and accessibility issues are addressed in modern comics, largely through the art.
Yeah, we're going to do something we've rarely done before. Try to describe art to you.
On an audio podcast. It's gonna be an adventure for everyone.
Be kind.
But first, we have feedback.
The Sutherlands, Darren and Ruth, sent some feedback about last episode, which was mostly made up of us replying to their feedback.
Ouroboros.
The feedback was mostly them talking about TV shows, so we're gonna hold off on that part of the feedback, the bulk of it, until we do another TV episode. But they did say this about Sleepy Hollow. Season 3 seems to be back on track from the mistakes of Season 2. Definitely enjoying it, though very sad to see the ratings are down significantly. We saw Tom Meson at Dragon Con, and he assured the audience that there are no plans to have him and Abby become a couple.
Oh, thank God!
He said the actors and writers agree that friendship is what makes the duo great. Hopefully the ratings drop won't force a change. Now, no spoilers, I have watched the first couple of episodes, and they do seem to have introduced potential love interests for both of their leads, and the potential girlfriend for Ichabod is pretty awesome. I'm shipping them right now.
Oh, excellent. It's another historical society interested in the past lady who finds him so very charming for his old-fashioned ways.
Exactly.
Good.
The perfect woman.
We also heard from our buddy, The Puzzler 6. This is feedback for our anniversary episode, but he also explains one of the great puzzles of our day, how he found our show. Dear Relatively Geeky, 6 to 8 months ago, I was listening to an episode of Noel's Remakes podcast.
That would be the terrific I Hate Love Remakes podcast by Noel Thingvall.
One of our favorite pod-fated shows.
Yes, there does not seem to be any new episodes coming, but we definitely encourage you to go back and listen to the inventory.
Oh, so good. That show is definitely one of my re-listens. Just go back occasionally and enjoy all of those episodes once again. Noel dropped the name of a little podcast network called Relatively Geeky. Curious, I began listening, and despite my better judgment, continued to do so.
That's how we keep listeners.
Yep.
Against everyone's better judgment.
Since then, it has become a favorite of mine, and here's hoping for another two, well, I want more than 2 years out of you, but let's just say a further infinity of years. As for the episode itself, I was very intrigued by the new show and hope to get many pleasurable hours reading slash listening to insane rants about Constantine from Emily, as well as the well-thought-out discussion that has become this show's trademark.
No spoilers, but Constantine will be getting a shout-out in episode 2 of Dorkness to Light, which should be out in a few weeks.
And at some point when I actually have free time, so January, I am going to go back and start reviewing the Constantine the Hellblazer ongoing series that's going on right now, which is phenomenal and insanely highly recommended. I love it. I'm sure Andrew Leyland does not, but it does a great job of summing up various Constantines and putting it all together in an interesting new story. Very British. Love it. Puzzler 6 continues, sorry to see Uncovering the Bronze Age go the way of Thomas and Martha Wayne, but better to end on a high note than unwillingly dragging it out. At least that's what my attitude would have been if Emily hadn't then begun talking about how she planned on incorporating my first love, the pulps and old-school sci-fi, into the show.
To be fair, you did break people's hearts by saying the show was ending, and then
twisted the knife
a little bit more and said, you know, but if I had done the shows, these are some of the things I would have talked about that you'll never get to hear.
It's what I do. Darn it, Emily. Why do you torture me by saying I might have had a chance to submit my 27-page paper on Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser and heartlessly snatch it away? As for the question at hand, see what I did there? I discovered the Faceless Fellow through JLU, as have some others, including an issue of Sir Denis O'Neill's run that I found in, wait for it, a quarter bin.
Yay!
The series seemed well done if a tad dark at times.
True.
Time to add yet another line to my ever-lengthening list of series to pick up. Congratulations once more on this blast of a binary birthday bash. The Puzzler 6.
Thanks, buddy. Kind words indeed. Next up is a blog post comment from longtime listener Neil Stanifer, the uncanny grammar merchant. This episode just popped up in my feed thanks to one of those frequent and inexplicable iTunes apoplexies, but I'm glad it did. It gives me the chance to cheer your love of The Maze Agency, which he describes as Moonlighting meets Nancy Drew, and Baker Street. Both excellent reads, even if the latter left far too much unresolved. Yes, it was a bummer it only went 10 issues, because the story did have a lot more life in it, I think.
Frankly, if we were going to talk about, you know, stories that we want to kind of come back, I'd like somebody to stumble across Baker Street and bring that back in our, you know, 3 or 4 years ago was sort of the peak of this, but in this, the tail end of this wave of Sherlock everything.
Slash steampunk. It sort of had, it was ahead of its time by 3 decades in a couple different ways, including some of the sexual identity and gender politics issues were in there as well. It had a lot, it was doing a lot of stuff.
We need this series back.
Neil continues that he confesses that much of the indie black and white stuff was amateurish rubbish. How the heck did The Crow, a comic that owed its entire existence to Joy Division lyrics and astonishingly naive tastes in art? Those are Neil's comments, not necessarily reflective of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, though they might actually be reflective of it, ever become not one, but several feature films. Seriously! I will stand up for Marvel's Savage Tales, which utilized black and white to showcase some truly breathtaking pencils and inks, which would have been swallowed up by the coloring process of the Bronze Age. Black and white has some merits, definitely.
Finally, just a few stray comments about the age of the indies. 1. Xenozoic Tales was underread and underwritten. 2. Concrete could be charming if ultimately forgettable. 3. To hell with Dave Sim. 4. Even the worst of amateur black and white indies were better than the pinup-driven age that followed. 5. Seriously, Dave Sim is a douche canoe. Neil.
Podcasting legend Michael Bailey wrote a while back, very politely, to discuss our stance on Dick Grayson's love life. We talked back in our Valentine's Day episode, I guess, about shipping Dick Grayson with Corey / Starfire. And not always digging him with Barbara Gordon as much. And part of that for us was sort of how closely they worked together as kids or teens, at least. And we thought that was just a little weird, a little odd. Michael pointed out that although they worked together, they didn't actually live together. They weren't stepbrother and sister. They weren't raised as brothers and sisters. And maybe our feelings of ickiness weren't necessarily on point.
Yep, I can see that. I think the sticking point for me is that I don't see them as a couple, like an egalitarian, reciprocating relationship. I can totally see Dick having a massive crush on Barbara. But I don't know. I don't really see her reciprocating, certainly not when they're younger.
Yeah, the details change over the years, but to me, Barbara's always, what, 5, 8, maybe even more years older than he is. To me, he's 12, 13, 14, and she's more 18, 19, 20, at least. For a lot of their working relationship. At least that's the way I've always envisioned it. And maybe that's sort of where the creep factor a little bit gets in for us, being stuck in that version of those characters.
And for me, it just feels like by the time that Dick is old enough that she would see him as a possible romantic partner, she's like 30. And that's the thing. Like, I don't see her reciprocating in the same way. I can totally see Barbara being his first love, but I don't think that Barbara ever had or would have feelings nearly as strongly.
Right. And in our defense, we did squee big time about Convergence, Nightwing, and Oracle.
Exactly.
So it's not like we're totally opposed to that ship.
Exactly. And I like to say this occasionally, shipping is about preference. It's, I prefer Dick's relationship with Corey because it does feel a little bit more a relationship of equals, that they are closer in age. They met each other in sort of neutral circumstances and worked together as teammates without that sort of
kind hierarchical
of,
structure
weird
almost,
hierarchy or, of the Bat family. I dig it more. But Dick Bad is still good.
And thank you, Michael, for your very polite, kindly worded scolding.
I don't think he does anything that isn't kind, polite, and well-worded. Like, it goes without saying.
I know that Michael was born and raised in Pennsylvania, but I think all that time living in Georgia, just a little bit of kindly Southern gentleman is creeping into his to his persona.
Seeping.
I can see him out just on the front veranda, sipping a mint julep, reading some comics,
yep,
typing some kindly worded criticisms to his favorite podcasters.
Eh?
We also got an email from Jim Rimoldi. He writes reviews over at the Batman Universe page. He wrote in about episode 25. Good day, Professor and Emily. I just finished listening to your coverage of Identity Crisis. Absolutely wonderful. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and your analysis is right on. I both love and not love this story. I admit that I've only read this once, but I do want to compare and contrast this story to a Batman story that I absolutely do not like, the other dark DC story, The Killing Joke. What Identity Crisis has, as we said, is heart. I started crying when you described the moment Diana put her hand on Sue's casket and said, "Farewell, sister." Darn it, I'm crying again typing this! That is my point. The only emotion I feel with Killing Joke is disgust and anger for what happened to Barbara Gordon.
This is actually going to bleed over into our discussion in the second half of the episode, but we wanted to touch on this a little bit here, that in comic books, it is really easy to fall into caricature. And I mean that for the writing as well as for the art.
Mm-hmm. It's simplicity.
Yeah. And
shortcuts almost.
And that's part of the point of comic books, because the stories are so short, you have to do a lot with not much page space. And that page space has to include art and dialogue. You've got to be really careful and precise with the words you use, because you can't just write a treatise. Well, yeah. I mean, you can, but it's not a good comic book.
Yeah, they're classic stories of people trying to break into comic book writing, perhaps from other forms of writing, novelist or something like that, and submitting that first script, and the editor saying, "Okay, well, you know there's going to be no room for anything on the page because your word bubbles will take up the entire page. You can't write 200 words of dialogue per page like you can in a novel. It's a different form of communication."
Exactly. And going back to Identity Crisis, I think that that's really a great example of why you should have novelists coming in to the comics medium, even if just to shake things up a little bit. With Meltzer, he takes a skill from novels, which I think is just so perfectly suited for writing in comic books. The ability to introduce minor characters that have a large impact. If you're writing a mystery story or, detective crime story, as he tends to do,
you need to have witnesses. You need to have the police officers on the scene. You need to have lots of side characters that may only appear for one or two scenes.
But they need to have a really big impact. They need to make an impression.
They need to be memorable in brief appearances.
Exactly. And that's what he really does with Sue. That even though she's in so little of the book and has so few lines of dialogue, her presence is felt because he is able to take that and basically say, okay, I'm only going to get 200 words of dialogue in total about this character in 7 issues. I have to make it count.
Mm-hmm.
And so he makes every single word like surgically precise and well realized and all of that sort of great stuff that you should do as a novelist. And to make another comparison between these two, how they're sort of opposites of each other, I personally don't think that The Killing Joke is that great a story, but everyone remembers it because of what happened in the aftermath. Same thing with Identity Crisis, but with Identity Crisis, the aftermath was awful, rapey Dr. Light,
right,
and just really a terrible contrived
maybe
plot
not the
lines.
Start of the darkening of DC, but it was a big step in that process.
Yeah, whereas the story itself, which is so wonderful, is largely forgotten
because of those implications.
Right, whereas I don't think anyone really remembers the Killing Joke as the story where Batman kills the Joker. They remember it as the origin of Oracle.
I think in the same way that Identity Crisis is sometimes downplayed a little bit, or the reason people dislike it is what followed in its wake. And I think, to some extent, people who like the Killing Joke, some of them like it because of what it left in its wake, which is Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, picking up that thread of the story and creating a really powerful second act for Barbara Gordon. And, you know, a disabled character being a real mainstream part of the DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of legacy, probably the legacy of the Killing Joke in that sense is much stronger, more positive than the legacy of Identity Crisis.
Yeah.
And I do think it's fair to compare the two stories. I mean, I think Jim is making a very fair comparison there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But back to Jim's email. Obviously, I did not like the violence that Sue was subjected to, but I fell in love with Ralph and Sue with this story. Join the really big club.
Yep.
On that, Jim.
Yep.
Yes. Their relationship was beautiful and loving, and that was evident throughout the story. None of those relationships were really touched upon in Killing Joke. Barbara Gordon, who I now knew a lot about, did not have any real characterization. She was just an object, just a plot device. I'm done talking about Killing Joke, but your coverage has inspired me to revisit Identity Crisis. Keep up the good work, Jim.
Well, that's another point for the tally board. We appreciate those kind words. I love how much people love talking to us about Identity Crisis. Like, mm-hmm. if that's our legacy with this show, I think I'm good with that.
Exactly. But I think he's right. You know, both stories had so much in terms of their implications. But I love what he said about the emotions that are generated mm-hmm. by those two stories. At least for him and for us, are really 180 degrees apart.
Exactly.
All right, let's take a break here, play a promo or two, and when we come back, Shortbox Showcase will go where no other relatively geeky episode has gone before, to a discussion of art.
Art!
Welcome to Astro City, a Pulp to Pixel Honor podcast. An issue-by-issue ratings Black and Black review of the creator-owned comic book series Astro City by the writer-artist team of Kurt Busiek, Brent Anderson, and Alex Ross. You can find episodes of Welcome to Astro City and other Pulp to Pixel podcasts at pulptopixel.blogspot.com. PulpToPixel.tumblr.com, through the iTunes Store under the Pulp to Pixel Podcast, and through Facebook at the Pulp to Pixel Podcast webpage. The Pulp to Pixel Podcasts, exploring the media multiverse of geek culture.
If you're a diehard X-Files fan, join me, Agent Shadow.
And me, Agent Chelsea.
As we cover all X-Files episodes and movies one by one. Just search iTunes for X-Files and subscribe to X-Files Truth.
And we're back. Now, when I originally came up with this concept for this episode, I wasn't going to say that it was the disability issue. That is not how I pitched this. However, between the two books we're going to be looking at today and Jim Romolda's fantastic email about Oracle, this is becoming a very special episode of Shortbox Showcase. The idea for this episode started several months ago, where in the depths of my Daredevil fandom, I went and picked up some Mark Waid Here Comes Daredevil. And it was super awesome, and I loved it. and talking about the Wade run on Daredevil with people on the internet, they frequently like to also mention a companion book, Matt Fraction's Hawkeye. And so,
I believe it's pronounced Hawk Guy.
Oh, right, sorry.
You know, like on MASH.
Yeah, Hawk Guy. Let's not bury the lead any further. The fact that in Fraction's run on Hawkeye, Hawkeye is revealed to have had hearing damage as a child and becomes re-deafened in the course of that run. So we've got two disabled, street-level vigilante butt-kickers, quote-unquote, with no superpowers.
In the Tumblr and fanfic world, Hawkeye and Daredevil, when they're hanging out with Cap, the three of them, they're sort of a nickname for them.
Yes, that would be the team-up of Deaf, Blind, and Dumbass, with Bucky just face-palming in the background.
Exactly.
Which is just
so, no Cap perfect. And Bucky in this episode. Focus mostly on Daredevil and Hawkeye. And a lot of it was about the art and some of the storytelling techniques in terms of telling the stories from different perspectives. And in the case of these two fellas, talking about how they're perceiving the world in a, you know, through their handicaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fair to tie into the first half of the episode to bring back Oracle for a little bit of a discussion here.
Yeah, because in a lot of ways, Daredevil and Oracle are sort of the go-tos for disabled superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actually a lot of parallels there with both of them just being highly trained martial artists and all that sort of thing. It sounds really dismissive, but sort of top of the B-list characters.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them are really headliners in a lot of the general consciousness in their two respective companies, but they're both pretty well known.
Are we breaking news to J. David Weider about this? I mean, does he not recognize, or
he's perfectly aware.
Okay, just want to make
Daredevil
sure we're
is the top of the B list.
I mean, if he needs a content warning before listening to this episode, I mean, are we breaking news to him? I just wanted to make sure.
But both of them are, I would say, the most visibly disabled superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, there is a certain amount of protectiveness that fans with disability have towards them. It's why a lot of people were outraged in the New 52 by taking Barbara out of the chair.
Now, when we're talking about disabilities here, we're talking about physical limitations,
yeah,
physical disabilities.
For these three in particular.
Exactly.
Some sort of physical condition that they have, which you would think might disqualify you from being a superhero, and which right. doesn't really slow any of them down.
There are a lot of characters in comics, mostly villains, but sometimes heroes as well, with mental or emotional issues or disabilities or addiction issues. And
mm-hmm.
that's not really where we're going here.
Right. And I mean, since we're talking about Daredevil, and we mentioned Bucky earlier, intense, deep depression
mm-hmm.
and PTSD, respectively.
Right. But again, just when we're talking about disabled or disabilities, we're talking physical limitations.
Mm-hmm. And because this is actually, you know, we're talking about three disabled superheroes, but that's three disabled superheroes from two companies in all of comics history.
True.
You know, you can probably think of a couple more, depending how you want to count Tony Stark and his heart condition.
Right, how you want to define some. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You might be able to come up with a few more. But these are pretty much the only three anyone knows about.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that fans, especially fans with disabilities, tend to be really, really protective
of
these three and that status.
And that's where the New 52 reversion of Barbara Gordon back into Batgirl was greeted with some anger, dismay.
Right.
Controversy.
Exactly. And for a lot of people, because they loved The Killing Joke, they loved the origin of Oracle, and they loved Oracle as a character in Birds of Prey.
For 20 years or so.
For 20 years. I mean, there were some nerds who had never known her as Batgirl.
Right. And other people had filled the Batgirl role, so.
Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, it was like, well, we don't need her to go back to being Batgirl because she is, I would say for a lot of people, more interesting as Oracle because then there are these limitations that she has to work around. And that just makes her unique. She stands out from the other members of the Bat family.
So losing that was a loss to many in the comic book fandom, especially those with interests in folks who are physically disabled. And that's where in the last 5 years, this Daredevil and this Hawkeye story sort of both coming. So we're looking at this sort of more modern, really 2010s take on this topic.
And not only are these both, you know, these are both recent developments, but they are both recent developments from Marvel. And this is the thing about Marvel is that they've been pretty good on diversity as well, a
obviously
goal.
Daredevil in the early 60s when it started. Now we can quibble that there were some areas where they didn't quite get it right, but they've had a blind superhero for 50 plus years.
Exactly. And in a lot of ways, Daredevil really paved that way for Oracle and eventually Hawkeye.
Fair. Right.
But I wanted to highlight that this is a very Marvel thing to do, is to find something that makes a character unique or is at odds with what you would expect for a character. Right. Oh, we're going to have this awesome ninja vigilante guy who parkours. Also, he can't see. And there's this you know, awesome sharpshooter guy who's like super cool and awesome and stuff. Oh, now he can't hear. How is that going to affect him? How is that going to throw off his balance? How's that going to change the way that he has to relate to people?
And for us as readers, how are we going to be receiving these stories, the art and the scripting? You know, how are the creators going to be dealing with that? And how is that going to impact us as readers? So that's really where I'm coming at this from is.
And that idea of looking at these different perspectives that the characters would bring in these books, that was my starting concept for this episode. Because I love when we talk about writing and character arcs and things like that, but those are things you can do in other media. But the stuff that we want to talk about in this episode, in our discussion on art, is stuff that only comic books can do. The way that panels are laid out and coloring and some of the interesting things that they come up with in the comic book to get over this limitation of, for example, your character being deaf. You cannot include word balloons in an issue. How are you going to tell the story without that quote-unquote crutch? So in this discussion, just if anyone's interested in reading along as we desperately attempt to describe art in an audio medium, describe art in audio that's describing being able to only hear in a visual-only audio-free medium.
Good luck.
Challenge accepted. So we'll specifically be looking at the first trade of Daredevil by Mark Waid, which is issues 1-6, and then two specific issues from the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run. Issue 19, obviously, the issue dealing with Clint's deafness, but also issue 11, which is simply known as the dog issue.
And what I like about Daredevil in terms of this idea is the cover of the first issue, it's also the cover of the trade, is an attempt to show us the way that Daredevil, I'm going to use the word sees, the way that Daredevil sees or perceives the world. And what you have is a classic cityscape of New York City with buildings and water towers and birds flying by. But each of those aspects, each of those
objects
is written as sound effects. So we don't actually see a bird. We see the words flap, flap, flap in the shape of a bird. We see the words glug, 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 glug in the shape of the water tower. So they're really telling us from the beginning that this is going to be about the way the Matt perceives the world.
Yes, and it's one of my favorite pieces of art, I mean ever, but it's a great piece of Daredevil art because you've got the classic swinging Daredevil, you know, fully realized, And then when you look at it, just from a distance, it almost looks like his radar sense with just the wibbly lines in the background. But the more you focus, the more you sort through the noise, the way Matt has to, the more you can pick up on the shapes of individual objects. When you first see it, you go, oh, that's an interesting style. And then you sort of figure out what it is. And you go, oh, that's a really cool idea. And then you start actually looking at it and you go, wow, that is great art. Because it is really, really detailed. Plays a lot with perspective, with distance, with angles, the way all great Daredevil art should. But it's sort of obfuscated. It's difficult for us to perceive it because it should be difficult to perceive.
Mm-hmm. And because this is a Marvel book and it's the beginning, you know, of a new run, I'm not totally sure who to credit all of these things to. You know, how much of these are Mark Waid, how much is Paolo Rivera, who penciled the first three issues, how much of it is editorial involved in making these decisions in terms of specifically the radar sense. How is the radar sense going to be portrayed?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's not the classic Marvel method, but still my hunch, my feeling, is that at Marvel, writers and artists can work a little closer together. Especially at this, because they had to pitch this book.
Mm-hmm.
This is the start of a new title. So I'm sure they had to come up with some ideas on how it was going to be different, what they were going to do. And, you know, whether Mark Waid said, let's make the radar sense different, try to make it look like this, or whether he said, Paolo, go ahead and do something with the radar sense, give us three or four things, and Waid had some impact, or editorial had, again, the specifics of that, we don't know exactly who to credit, so it's really Mark Waid and Paolo Rivera really working together, I think, to some extent to develop some of these things. And specifically, it's the radar sense that I think is quite different from prior versions.
Because the prior versions have often been the concentric rings of just sort of showing basically a bullseye on whatever Matt's focusing on. But in this, they do a brilliant job of really trying to come up with something that vaguely would approximate this sense of distance, where they use lots of black and magenta, basically in bands, in order to give sort of like an infrared sort of look. And then everything is just made up of these bands of dark and light right next to each other, which give the outlines of things.
Right.
You can get approximate distance, but you don't really get details. Definitely, you know, facial expressions you don't really pick up. You know, large gestures you can see.
Mm-hmm. Colors of clothing.
Color and light difference.
Mm-hmm.
There is no difference.
Right.
And I just think that does a great job of sort of getting us in Matt's head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great way to start off the issue by really just showing that sort of level of perception.
There's also a great scene in about partway through issue one where Matt is meeting someone. Is it up on the roof? What we get from his narration are things like, I thought this was really interesting because it's probably something we do. The woman who's meeting, you know, scuffs her shoes a little bit out of politeness, really, to make sure that he recognizes that someone's there. And he picks up on that.
Right.
So I really and like it's some of those things.
It's a really nice process because he's thinking to himself so much for solitude on the rooftop. Act surprised.
Mm.
Because he has noticed her, but he knows that he, quote unquote, shouldn't have.
Right.
And then later notes she scuffs her shoes to warn the blind guy. That's very thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's that sort of process of his maintaining his identity, which is always also really interesting to me, of the way he juggles that, of what he's aware of, what he pretends not to be aware of.
What things he will allow beautiful women to help him with.
Yes.
Well, yes, you do probably need to hold me a little closer when we walk across the street, ma'am. He learned that one in college. I think Foggy as wingman, I think, helped him a little bit. With some of these, it's always with the ladies.
How would I know that she's hot? This again? You always know! So he has radar sense and hottie sense.
but I just thought that scene just showed he was aware of her. He was aware of what she was doing to make herself noticeable to him. I just thought that was a really second or third level of insight into what it's like to be blind.
And also something that I like in the art here is that it shows what is going on behind Matt. That's another thing I find interesting his radar sense is that he has 360-degree vision.
Right.
And this will come up when we talk in Hawkeye a little bit about sight lines, but Matt essentially doesn't have them. That he can see something 50 feet behind him as well as something 50 feet below him or above him or in front of him. Because this is the first issue, later on, there's a little bit of playing with what Daredevil's limitations are and what sort of things mess with his senses. So later in the issue, he has a confrontation with Captain America. And in order to prove that it is Daredevil, Cap shoots anti-radar chaff at him. So there's all of this...
It's confetti.
That's all around him, and it throws off his perception because there's stuff all around him. I think in the comics they've said that he hates going out in the rain for the same reason, because it's just white noise.
Right. Everything's splashing. There's noise all around. The drops are interfering with the sound waves. They're you know, echoing and bouncing.
And it interferes with his distance. It's essentially like walking around everywhere in fog. At times, Matt's senses have gotten just ridiculous, over the top.
Sure.
This is another reason why we're not talking about the Silver Age Daredevil books right now. Because sometimes they would even say, not just he can read newsprint with his fingers because it's raised, but he can read things that are laser jet printed or laminated, or he can actually distinguish color by smell. And I'm like, that's insane. That's ridiculous.
That's interesting that you're trying to build on that trope of all his other senses are raised, but there's a point at which it's absurd. And I think Wade here is trying to keep us on this side of it becoming absurd.
Yeah. And also, essentially, erasing any of his disability.
Right, right.
That if he can perceive color, and he can perceive motion, and he can tell all of these things by compensating with his other senses, if there's there's nothing he can't do, then you've sort of missed the point of having a hero who is both a hero and disabled.
But it's something they talked about in the TV show a little bit, about the heightened senses, in terms of especially his skin being so sensitive. And here in issue 2, they have a very funny moment about how sensitive his hearing is.
And his smell. That Foggy is in the next office over, in their offices, you know, probably 50 feet away. Matt's trying to relax, and then he hears crunch, 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 and goes over, storms into the other office, and Foggy's eating Cheetos. It's like, Foggy, we've talked about this. You cannot have Cheetos in the office. And he picks up the bag, and a giant comedic cloud of Cheeto dust just comes at Matt's face, and he desperately tries to wave it away. A thing in the art in that sequence is that it gave us a great thing that you can only do in comics, where they're actually building the scene out of the sound effects. So the panels of Matt recognizing, oh God, no, not Cheetos again, are interspersed with the sound effects of this really loud, obnoxious crunching. And then when he goes from his office to Foggy's, the hallway is actually the sound effect of crunch connecting the two, giving you a sense of origin or where this thing is coming from. And so you can sort of, you can follow it along like a trail, like Matt has to do, following the sounds and the smells.
And then probably my favorite page, there's a two-page spread in issue 2 of Matt and Foggy walking down the street in New York City. And again, this does something that really only comic books can do. For one thing, if you look carefully at the piece of art, Matt and Foggy are in about four or five places, because it's showing them walking, and you know, it has them at different parts of the block. And in each case, you're seeing how Matt is seeing the world different than Foggy is seeing the world. You have odors and sounds and things like that that are much more noticeable to Matt, where basically Foggy is just seeing and hearing, and Matt is doing a lot more perceiving of things around him, including, you know, telling Foggy he's about to step in doggy do, for example, because he smells it, and Foggy is unaware of that.
Mm-hmm. And the way that it's shown is that you have the giant four-color gorgeous mm-hmm. picture, which is essentially what Foggy sees.
Right.
And then overlaid on that image are little cutout panels
mm-hmm.
highlighting specific things, like the doggy do, like the flapping of a pigeon's wings,
right.
somebody's conversation
mm-hmm.
100 feet away.
Right. Music coming out from somebody's headphones that are mm-hmm. up a little too loud.
Or the smell of some girl's shampoo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the scene is in a lot of ways comedic as well as sort of
right, yes.
exposition-y. But there's a moment where there are two women on opposite sides of Matt and Foggy. Foggy mentions the one on the left because she's very attractive. But Matt notices the one on the right because she has a nice-smelling shampoo.
Mm-hmm.
And the one on the left has a smoker's cough.
Mm-hmm.
Even just that sort of what Matt finds attractive
right.
is different than what Foggy finds mm-hmm. attractive.
There's another great scene in issue 2 in the subway
mm-hmm.
and about Matt learning to play music by ear.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny. He just walks up to a guy with a violin playing on the subway and says, oh, can I try? And Foggy asks, can you play the violin? And Matt's like, well, let's find out. And of course, it's screeching horrific noise. And you see the music superimposed over the panels. And it's
jagged and the notes are
disgusting.
Out of place.
And awful, and everyone's wincing and covering their ears. But Matt is listening very, very carefully to it, and essentially over the course of a minute and a half as the subway goes by, picks up how to play the violin. And of course, you know, bows at the end, gives the violin back to the musician. He's very impressed by this little trick. Those little abilities
mm-hmm.
that Matt has that's not related to him being able to punch people.
Right.
I like when it examines those sorts of just
right.
skills and tricks and stuff that he is able to do using his senses to compensate.
I mean, but we know there are people that can learn music by ear, and if that sense is slightly enhanced,
or excruciatingly
enhanced, you could do it really, really quickly and really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we get to these first two issues, you pretty much have, you know, this template is laid out for visually how we're going to see Daredevil and how he is seeing the world. And what I liked about this run is there's some neat choices of villains as well that are just wildly appropriate for Daredevil, including
right.
Claw, the Master of Sound,
mm-hmm.
and if you think about it, Mole Man. They are pretty much equally sighted, so it works quite well there.
Mm-hmm. I really particularly like the Claw issue
mm-hmm.
because first he's fighting Claw's minions, which are made solely of sound, and how utterly off his game
mm-hmm.
Matt is having to fight these guys because his ears are telling him there's something there, but there's no heartbeat and his radar sense isn't pinging
right.
on anything.
Right.
I cannot Mm-hmm. get a cohesive image. I cannot
right.
get my senses to agree on what's happening. And it just totally throws him off balance.
Yeah, because with this radar sense, we get the idea that that is his mind pulling all of these things together. It's whatever he might be touching or smelling or hearing or the heartbeats. And
air
his
currents and distance and,
mm-hmm.
you know,
the
heat
echoes and so on. And that's sort of forming this radar picture for him. And here, so much of that is missing. He is totally discombobulated by this fight. And that's visually portrayed in a really interesting way.
And at the end of that particular issue, he ends up, you know, blowing up the bad guy's laboratory and blowing out his own eardrums.
Oops.
Leaving him blind again and desperately trying to make his way back to the office, back to his apartment, out of the way of oncoming traffic. And so that's just an interesting little arc there of another chance to highlight how his senses work and how his senses let him down, mm-hmm. that he is not right. perfect all the time. And of course, then there's a humorous follow-up sequence where Matt's yelling at everyone and Foggy's like, dude, stop yelling. I'm not yelling! Am I yelling? I'm sorry! Ear damage.
Which is, you know, how we've all felt leaving a loud concert or a sporting event or something like that, where it's just funny for Matt to be having those issues as well as all of his others.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they play on his vulnerabilities, what he can perceive and can't perceive. And there's a great scene. It's at the end of issue 4 and then becomes the cover of issue 5. You know, Matt and another, he's protecting a blind boy. And the two of them are, you know, standing out the window saying, don't worry, you know, I'll keep you safe. And he and the boy are covered with, you know, laser rifle
sights. Yeah.
But I like the idea that that's something he can't perceive. Because there's no heat, there's no sound, there's nothing there for him to perceive. What he does eventually hear, though, he hears, from a couple hundred yards away, the gun cock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he, and maybe an elevated heartbeat or sweat or something.
He hears the gun cock, and he says it's a sound that might or might not be a bolt action assault rifle.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to get a more complete picture, you listen for certain key phrases like "help," "give me the money," or very importantly, "on my mark."
Mm.
And at the moment, as soon as this other guy says "on my mark," he grabs the kid, and they both hit the deck.
Right. But I love this idea that he wasn't feeling the laser.
It wasn't the lasers that tipped him off. It was everything else.
Right.
And then, of course, because it's Mark Waid's version of Daredevil, and Mark Waid's version of Daredevil actually has lighthearted, humorous mm-hmm. moments. Mm-hmm. Of course, then, you know, it's the middle of the night, so the tactical assault team goes to bust into Mr. Murdoch's apartment with their night vision goggles. Oh no, one unarmed blind man versus 4 men in night vision goggles. Whatever shall I do? He turns on the light. They all scream because they've just been blinded.
All that additional light didn't really affect him much.
No, not a lot.
You know, we've read probably 3 or 4 trades of this run, I think. And I really liked, there's a great Christmas story in there. I'm pushing for us to cover somewhere this holiday season or next.
It's really good.
There's some Doom. Again, the Mole Man stuff is in a later trade. I just think it's a really great run. And it is a neat mix of the story and the art really working together to show how this person with a different set of senses than we have is perceiving the world.
And they get to do a lot of fun things that you can only do in comic mm-hmm. books. One of my personal favorite, it's a little cheesy, but I love it, is anytime Matt Murdock, attorney at law, is standing in a room saying something to comfort his client, don't worry, everything will be all right, justice will be served, any mm-hmm. of those sort of platitudes, but on the wall behind him, his shadow is Daredevil.
Yeah.
Anytime that happens, I am a fan of it.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned with the sound effect earlier, you know, in a comedic sense of Foggy and the Cheetos, they do that a lot throughout the run of, at one point, there's a speedboat chase. And in the background of all the panels, like around the border, you can hear the engine revving as it mm-hmm. slowly gets closer and Matt slowly becomes aware of it. And then when the speedboat actually gets there, the boat itself is just made of the sound effect.
Right.
So doing things like that to really give that sense of sound having weight
right.
in Matt's senses, in Matt's worldview, I really like.
Right. We also wanted to talk about Hawkeye. Now, in terms of the sort of the disability side of it, that doesn't kick in till issue 19 when he loses his hearing. But up until that point, there is still some really interesting stuff happening with the art and with the manner of storytelling. And I really enjoyed it. And it's in this case, it's Matt Fraction and mostly David Asia doing most of the art.
And their collaboration is amazing. Like, as good as the art and the writing work together in Daredevil.
It might be even better here.
I don't think it even holds a candle to how good Fraction and Asia are.
And the thing is, some of these issues, as I was reading the trade, I kept thinking, this is so gimmicky. This is so gimmicky. This is so good. This is so gimmicky. I don't know that it's really a gimmick. It's really good. The premise of the book at all is to some extent a gimmick. It's an Avenger when he's not being an Avenger. But then you get to some of the storytelling. They're doing things by the time you get to issue 8. That entire issue is told as a series of romance comics from the 50s. And you have to see it to understand it. But what works about that particular issue not being a gimmick is that there are actually clues in the covers that relate to later events in the story. So what seems like a total gimmick ends up working. There's a holiday issue in that that is totally insane.
Yeah, told in the style of a Charlie Brown Christmas special or a ambiguous winter solstice non-denominational festive TV special.
It's crazy stuff. It's gimmicky, but somehow it works within the storytelling.
I've said it before. Unsubtlety is not the same thing as being bad.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of stuff that's going on, specifically in the specials or the fill-ins, the issues that really are the most gimmicky, that have the fill-in artists and they're doing their own little story that sort of fits in between the ongoing story. They are insane. Ridiculous, over-the-top, crazy concepts. But they're all handled really well. And right. They have a very high level of quality for the writing, for the art. And each one is doing something very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see how this really wouldn't work as like a monthly series, because there's a lot of weird stuff that happens with time. And on top of that, even when you read it as a trade, it's barely a coherent story, because the way the issues are ordered is bizarre.
So the first trade was, we think, the only trade that actually put the stories in order.
Yeah.
The second trade covers 6 through 11, but it starts with 7.
Yeah.
And then goes to 6. And then 8, 9, 10, 11. And don't even get me started by the time we get to the fourth volume.
It's ridiculous.
It is so out of order. There are ones that are missing that I guess are in 3, right? 3 and 4 have the second half of the publication order in such a different order. But they're acknowledging the weird way that the story has been ordered and are attempting to make it make a little more coherent sense, I guess.
And I think a lot of them were numbered because of mm-hmm. when they came out, but
right.
not the order that they were
right,
written
exactly.
in.
Because there's a lot going on with time. The four trades, again, we'll talk about the art specifically, but the four trades cover, we think, 22 or 23 issues. And that, in essence, is telling one story that takes place really over maybe a couple
Six
of...
6 weeks.
Yeah, couple of months, maybe, from what we can tell. There are a lot of cases where you're revisiting scenes from different characters' perspectives. So there's a little bit of Rashomon happening here. There's a little bit of repetition. There's a little bit of seeing events out of sequence.
Intentionally.
Yes, intentionally out of sequence that you are then, in your mind, trying to put together in sequence. You know, this is a very highly regarded run, and I can understand why. I can understand why critics love it, but I think it really works as well. You know, there's some things that critics love just because it's unique or because it's experimental. This is unique. This is experimental. I also think it's really good.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great story that's being told. Like, the characters and the mm-hmm. relationships and the plot are all great. But then on top of that, the next layer of awesomeness, before we even get to the icing on the cake, is the art style.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the art is laid out is, in a lot of ways, really blocky. And lots of very small panels and a lot of use of white space. Not in the panels, in between the panels.
Right.
Of having only two small panels in the middle of a page and having white space on either side of them going to the edge of the page.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give this interesting sort of feeling of, at times, isolation.
Also, you know, the panel layout, the panel structure has something to do with how quickly or slowly we read it.
Right.
So there's something about the time of the storytelling, the amount of time it's taking to read.
Yeah, and building in the
that's
pacing.
That's being affected, right, exactly. The first specific issue we wanted to talk about is issue 11, which is where they take this idea of telling the story from another perspective to another level, where the perspective is that of Hawkeye's dog.
Which sounds like such a ridiculous gimmick.
But the art is gorgeous in it, again, because of the way Asia is showing the dog's perspective with little pictograms of various things and events and who is connected to who and what this person means.
For example, there's not a lot of focus on people's faces.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly it's people's word balloons, but only the certain words that the dog knows. So, Kate, don't, up, you, low, what, pizza, good boy.
Right, there are word balloons, but they're basically written like the way Charlie Brown's teacher speaks.
Mm-hmm.
So you get murmur, 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 up, murmur, murmur, you, murmur, murmur, low, you, murmur, murmur, good dog. The dog is attempting to think, attempting to put things together. So there's at one point, Clint's brother shows up. And the dog is a little bit confused by that because they look alike, they sound alike, they genetically, they probably smell alike. They're the things that the dog can perceive. You know, he knows it's not Clint, but he's confused by who this person is for a little while.
And he recognizes that there's a connection there,
yes,
but does not know what it is.
Right.
But the way the dog recognizes people is actually kind of similar to the way that Matt recognizes people, that they are a collection of various attributes. So when he hears, looks at, is smelling Clint, what he is thinking is the bow. He pets me. He feeds me. He smells like coffee all the time. when he's sitting next to Kate, the other Hawkeye, it's she also has a bow, but she smells like flowers and martini, and she wears makeup and feeds me pizza and hugs me, and I love her.
You know, this is part of a murder mystery. You know, a death has occurred, and the dog found the bodies. That's the plot aspect of the story. So at one point, you've got the dog, you know, running through the apartment, and as he goes by each apartment door, again, it's this flash of pictograms in terms of who lives there, what's happening behind those doors. And there are scenes in here that are repeated both prior and after from other people's perspectives. And that is something you don't notice until you're reading it in quick succession, for one thing. And you have enough of the story,
of the context,
in your brain at one time that you realize, I have seen this exact scene before. Oh, no, I saw it from Clint's perspective. I saw it from the police officer's. I saw it from the bad guy's perspective. I saw it from Kate's perspective. Now I'm seeing it from the dog's perspective. And it actually makes a little more sense now.
And that's the thing, is remember, this is issue 11.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of story that is covered in this issue from the dog's perspective is
right.
Issues 9 through 14.
Right.
So
it's a weird recap / flash forward preview, but you don't know that when you're reading this cold.
Exactly. So what happens when you read it is the first half or so you vaguely recognize. Maybe like third. You mm-hmm. recognize, oh, this happened and this was when they were here, and oh, that's when they found the body.
Haven't the police already been up? Oh, okay. They're doing that
they're
scene again.
It.
Okay.
All right. But then the story proceeds. Mm-hmm. And you think to yourself, I don't know what's going on. Is this the only way we're going to see this story play out?
Right.
So you get a good amount of information there, but you have no context for it. So, for example, there is a spoiler revealed in this mm-hmm. issue about how the bad guys keep getting into Clint's building. because it turns out that one of the tenants is the bad guy's mother. There's one point where the dog's former owners, the bad guys, go and beat the dog up and grab it and are like, it's coming home. It's our dog. And the dog, Lucky, wakes up in the mother's apartment. And you're like, what's going on? I vaguely recognize her. Why are the bad guys here? But not only are they speaking and he doesn't really know what they're saying, they're speaking in Russian. The dog is picking up on one or two words there, but those one or two words are in Russian. We have no idea what's going on, right. And we don't find out what's going on until, like, issue 17, where it's revealed that that's the mother and that she lets the bad guys in, and that's where you realize, oh, no, there's a mole.
It is an inside job. The little nice old ethnic lady, she's the inside job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this sort of tells us in advance what Lucky's doing during these course of events, because then through issue 14, the dog is just absent.
Right.
And there's a brief mention of it in issue 12, like, oh man,
I haven't seen the dog for a while.
Kate took my dog. And Barney's like, I'm pretty sure the dog just left. And yes, we've seen that the dog just left. The dog left on its own to go off and wander and get into adventures that eventually come back to bite Clint in the butt, as most things in this story do.
So again, it works as a standalone comic book experiment.
Mm-hmm.
It works as a unique perspective on storytelling. And it works as part of this bigger arc that Fraction is telling. And I think I speak for both of us. We want to be DC fans.
Mm-hmm.
The books that we're reading new that we're actually paying money for are DC books. But I just don't think DC could pull this off, because I don't think they could guarantee a writer and an artist 22 straight issues. And the DC, that's not their model at this. Their model is 6 issues. If it's working, stay. If it's not, you're gone. But between Wade here and Fraction and Bendis and many other writers, Jonathan Hickman and Dan Slott, Marvel creators and creative teams have been given lots and lots of freedom, lots and lots of room to tell their stories. And with a few exceptions, on the DC side, creators really have not had that opportunity.
Yeah.
And you miss out on some really interesting storytelling, I think, when you're that short-sighted.
Indeed. And just the way that Lucky's thought process is shown in this story is amazing. Because you get the feeling the dog is smart.
Right.
The dog knows what's up.
The dog's a dog.
But it's a dog. And so he's a professional guard dog. So Clint says, you, keep an eye on the place. And of course, in the dog's mind, the dog salutes, which is just adorable. And then he's parked out in front of the building as all of the sirens and the lights are going off and people are crossing the street and there's conversations and there's pigeons and he wants to chase a cab, but he's not going to chase a cab because he's got a job to do. And he goes and take a bathroom break, come right back. There's a cat, not going to chase the cat. Got to sit right here. Got to do my job. And that's all conveyed in one picture with 15 pictograms.
Right.
And you get an entire thought process and an entire story out of that. And I think a lot of this issue is just Fraction and Asia proving that they can.
Yes.
So that later on, they have a little bit of a template to go with. And people have, in a way, kind of had a primer on understanding their stories that are going to be presented like this with almost no dialogue and lots of plot.
Right. Exactly. That's the amazing thing. When you say very little dialogue, it's not that they're making up for the dialogue with caption boxes. Or, I mean, there's not many words of English in the issue, but it's not a silent issue. And it is an issue, as you said, where lots of stuff happens, including stuff we hadn't seen before happen.
It covers 5 issues of plot.
Yeah.
Okay, so think about that. That much stuff happens in this book. And there's about 30 words in the whole thing.
Yeah. It comes off as not a gimmick because of the context.
Right.
And then 19 as well, the deaf issue.
Mm-hmm. Basically could, builds on that.
Again, but it could also be a gimmick if it hadn't been part of this broader template and if it hadn't sort of flowed naturally from what they had done before. So as Emily pointed out before, what we're getting in 19 is both flashback to Clint's boyhood where he had some hearing issues as a result of being knocked around by dear old dad. And it's also telling the current day version of an event that leaves his hearing again in trouble. And we get a lot of speech balloons that are blank.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what a great way of demonstrating deafness, because the person knows conversation is happening, but they can't hear it.
Right. Something that I liked specifically with the blank word balloons was that it sort of showed Clint's emotional state, that he's not even trying. He just recognizes discussion is happening and I don't care. He's essentially ignoring everything that's going on around him because he's ever so slightly in denial. About halfway through the issue, it's revealed he's a sniper. He's a professionally trained spy. He's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. He can read lips. Just up until this point, he hasn't even bothered trying.
Right. And as that's revealed, sometimes he's sort of getting back into it a little bit. So you start to transition where there'll be speech bubbles where some of the words are clear.
Or everything's printed at an angle.
Right.
Or with brackets or with letters missing. Because he's doing his best to sort of pick up on what's happening around him, but he's not getting a complete picture.
Right. We also get some American Sign Language in this issue as well, as a way of the Barton brothers communicating.
Which is a thing they set up because Clint had to learn sign language when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he's rusty now. So a lot of times when there's signs that are shown in a pictogram, there'll be a question mark next to it. Because Clint's like, I'm pretty sure I know what that means,
right,
but I'm still not entirely sure.
And by the way, the ASL, the lip reading, we do not get an editor's note of the translation. So we as readers are as lost as Clint is in this.
Exactly.
Probably more so, actually, because he is understanding some of the ASL, and I, for one, am not.
It's moments like this that I'm really, really glad that we had a deaf teacher in my high school.
That's right.
So every single student at least learned basic finger spelling about a vocabulary of 15 or 20 words and what a name sign was.
Mm-hmm.
That got me pretty far. So you do not have to be fluent.
No.
First of all, building from the dog issue, we've essentially had a primer on how to read a comic with plot and no English.
Right. Plot and pictures.
So if you do not get any of the ASL.
I got none of it.
The pictures are there to help you. Oh, you got some of it because you knew the finger spelling.
Oh, that is true.
And when someone uses a name sign underneath it, it's finger spelled out.
Right.
But it is not in an editor's note.
Right.
So for Clint, it spells out C-L-I-N-T, but his actual name sign is a V on his forehead.
Mm-hmm.
So later on, people make that sign.
Right.
And that's his name, rather than spelling it out every time, because nobody does that.
Mm-hmm.
You get the same thing for Barney, also has a name sign that you can pick up being used once or twice. What you're essentially reading is a non-English comic.
Right.
That the ASL is treated essentially as a foreign language. But so that you don't get entirely lost, about every other page, it's intercut with a more regular page with dialogue.
Right. It's someone else, the bad guys. It's, a subplot or side characters who are not deaf.
Right. And are having a discussion.
So you have that too. I needed that to anchor myself. I was awash in a sea of, what is going on here?
Right. It builds on itself, that it starts off with just blank word balloons, no signs. Then it's a few blank word balloons and some signs. And then more and more signs are creeping into it as it goes along, helping you to build up to what's happening and being able to maybe muddle through a little bit of the ASL, if you can. And if not, by about halfway through is when you start getting the finger spelling.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, there is now lots of ASL and a little bit of lip reading to help you fill in the gaps.
Right. And again, this is telling part of this longer story with the tracksuit mafia and the Russians. This one does push the plot forward. So it's not even like the dog issue, where you can almost say it's a bit of a recap and a bit of a preview. This really does push the story forward.
Mm-hmm. It is its own self-contained plot.
Mm-hmm. But it does give us a bit of a perspective, to some extent, what a deaf person goes through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in trying to make sense of the world around them. And I thought it was, again, another really interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
A little gimmicky, again, but I hope listeners are recognizing that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's not insult.
I often use the word that way in a negative sense, but here it is really working. It is just doing things, and this combination of the ASL and the word balloons, both the blank ones and the lip-reading ones, again, it's comic books doing what comic books can really do.
Mm-hmm. And it's something that I appreciated, that it wasn't just a gimmick for this one issue.
Right.
That throughout the next three or so issues in the trade,
mm-hmm.
if somebody's looking away from Clint and talking, it's an empty word balloon.
Right.
Because he can't see their lips. Or he'll still have moments where someone's talking to him and they're talking really quickly.
Right.
And it will have two or three words and then it'll just say buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually by the end of the trade, things are largely getting back to normal. Clint gets a cochlear implant,
mm-hmm.
which will mean that in later issues, the ASL, the blank
right.
speech balloons, the lip reading will be less prominent.
Mm-hmm.
But the cochlear implant itself, the hearing aid, is huge.
Right.
And it's bright purple because it's Hawkeye's.
So it
it's
will...
It's visible.
It is part of him.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard really good things about the Hawkeye run, and I had heard that there were some weird individual issues that were really highly well thought of, but I didn't realize how good the overall story was and just how well structured
mm-hmm.
the Hawkeye story was, start to finish. And I was thinking about these sort of gimmicky issues, some of these one-offs and the fill-ins, and I was thinking that it's more structured like a video game. If you think of those issues as the side quests, because they're not pointless. You know, stuff's happening in those issues, but it's not the main quest.
Right. So it's not the primary plot.
And this idea of jumping back and forth is almost like a save point, where you're going back and you're seeing the scene again. Hopefully you're playing it a little differently, or you wouldn't have died and needed to go back to your save point. So you get the idea of starting over again or seeing a scene again, but it's developing a little differently from there. So I was thinking of it as structured as a video game. Don't know if that's what Fraction was thinking about in terms of the design, but that might be a way of thinking about how this is organized. It is certainly not organized in a serialized format.
No.
Because again, literally, the issues in the trades are not presented in order of publication. They are jumping around in the timeline to attempt, I guess, to make it more readable as a trade. But that is evidence of the fact that it had this otherworldly structure to it.
That's the thing, is I really enjoyed each individual episode is mm-hmm. like a chapter in a video game.
Right.
That it is its own thing. It has its own goals and its own structure, and the way you're going to proceed through it.
And in some cases, its own art style.
Right. But altogether, it did tell a complete story. But it's this very strange blend of being, if it weren't a serial, and it weren't broken up into those different, distinct, like, right. puzzle pieces, then I don't think it would be as good. But you right. could almost have pitched it as an original graphic novel, and just had each chapter change. But there wouldn't have been that pressure
yeah.
to change, and we would have missed out on a lot of those weird
You would have wondered
little...
why are the side quests. Well, if you're thinking in terms of monthly issues. And what I liked about the side quests is that David Asia did most of the art. Then they had their main fill-in guy was Francesco Francavilla. A lot of people understand that, and he has his own unique sense of coloring and art.
And something that I liked was there was almost like a continuing subplot.
Between
those Francavilla issues. Because if you took those particular issues and put them next to each other, there was a lot of repetition within
right.
those issues because it was that different, unique art style. that one was a flashback to the villain's childhood.
Right.
And one was a flashback to Clint and Barney's childhood. Mm-hmm. And you could sort of see the parallels in between them. But then, in both of those issues, you had Barney Barton bumping into Pizza Dog.
Right.
And you had the bad guy, Kazu, bumping into Pizza Dog. So there was this like ongoing subplot between these weird, unique, one-off issues that interacted with the main story, but also had its own thing.
It wasn't needlessly complicated in a Grant Morrison sense.
Right.
It was not timey-wimey in the Red Sun sense. You know, it wasn't doing those to me are almost gimmicks. This did have a really natural feel to it. Again, I think it's the critical praise that it gets is really well deserved.
Mm-hmm. And I think it does something really well for a story about someone with a disability.
Right.
Is it really gets the feeling of disorientation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that comes up in Daredevil as
right.
well,
right.
is disorientation. That's why that claw issue was so good.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the issue where he fights Captain America is so good, because Matt is disoriented.
Right.
Things aren't lining up quite right. There's gaps in his perception. Things are complicated and difficult and hard to keep track of, and you're just trying to follow the through line. You know there's one,
and
but you're not quite sure what it is.
And as
readers, we're being brought along on that journey of that feeling of, I'm not entirely sure what's going on. I'm picking up bits and pieces. That's why Hawkeye works so well
right.
as a story about a disabled person and also as a murder mystery. Because we are given clues that we
right.
don't have any way to integrate into the story yet.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we know more than Clint does at times.
Oh, come on. Everyone knows more than Clint does at times.
Okay. So since everyone knows more than Clint does at any given point in the story, we aren't solving the mystery
right.
before he does, because we still don't know how to put the pieces together
right.
until we get that final piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. And we sort of joked about, we didn't want to turn this into the very special episode dealing with handicaps. These books don't deal with themselves as the very special episodes dealing with handicaps.
And that's what's so good about them.
That's what works about them. These are the farthest thing from PSA comics that you can find.
Mm-hmm.
Right. These are not preachy comics. These are telling great stories, and among the things that they're doing is maybe trying to give us a glimpse of what it's like to be Daredevil, or to be Hawkeye, or to be Hawkeye's dog.
Exactly. And that is also a great thing that not only comic books can do, but that comic books should do.
Mm-hmm.
Is give you a chance to glimpse into the lives of other people.
Mm-hmm. That's the positive side of diversity.
Exactly.
That's what diversity of all kinds can do. And sometimes it all can get preachy. It can all get PSA-ish. And they've really avoided that here.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're hearing that and saying, ooh, I don't want to be preached at, these are not that.
Mm-hmm. And this is why it's a good thing for media to cater to these special groups. For example, because I'm pretty sure I can't go a single episode without talking about the Daredevil Netflix show. The audio descriptive track on that show is so good. It's such a different way of experiencing
mm-hmm.
that media. I'm not blind, but I like the audio descriptive track. I'm not deaf, but I like having subtitles.
Right.
It actually does make life better or more interesting, more enjoyable for everyone having
mm-hmm.
those sorts of options. I was very happy in 2011, I think. They said that they were starting to do audio descriptive comics, and they started
mm-hmm.
with Daredevil. Obviously.
Perfect choice. Yeah, they've been doing audio descriptive, well, I think it was Books for the Blind.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was vinyl records. The concept goes that far back. I know they've done that with newspapers before. So in essence, look, I don't want to say they had it better than us, but they had podcasts way before anyone else did. I don't want to... No.
Well, but that's the thing is...
Exactly.
You start by producing these sorts of things of news shows that are specifically for the blind, and then other people are like, hey, that's actually a pretty good idea.
You know, I'd like an audiobook too.
Right? If I wanted to pick up a print book, I could just read it. But I have friends who have vision mm-hmm. problems or who are dyslexic, and they need audiobooks.
Right.
So audiobooks are important.
We just get to enjoy them.
But I get to enjoy them. Like, everybody wins.
Exactly.
And if these issues just showed, like, if you wanted for some reason to do a comic where all of the dialogue was in ASL, you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
If that was a thing you wanted to do, you could. You know, they've proven it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally would be kind of interested in reading that thing
mm-hmm.
if it were ever to happen.
Yeah, there have been silent issues of comics, a handful of them. They can be well received. They usually are interesting reads. I guess that's still the right word. I mean,
yeah.
you're still partaking of the art and the storytelling visually. So I guess I would still call them interesting reads. You know, but I don't think anyone's tried that for an entire series or entire run. But dropping in some of these other things are really, really interesting.
Not to dismiss any of the episodes that we've done for the last few months, but let me just say, personally, it's a real nice return to form to do a nice long episode digging into some interesting aspects of comic books as a medium. It's been a while. You know, I love our TV episodes. I love our, you know, quick review episodes, but this just scratched an itch that I have had building for like 6 months.
We think this is the type of show that we do pretty well. So we are glad to have you on this journey with us. And we would love to hear from you about the concepts, the topics we covered, the specific books that we covered.
Send that through email to relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or you can comment on the blog post on our website, relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
If you haven't, we would encourage you, invite you to leave an iTunes review for the show. That is always good, helps people find the show. And you want that, don't you?
Yes, we want more people in the fold, listening to our rambling, me crying about Constantine and talking about the Marvel Netflix Daredevil audio descriptive track, because that's basically what this podcast has turned into.
It took us over 80 minutes, but we finally can check those minimum requirements for an episode off the list.
So until next time, remember, even though we've talked to you for almost an hour and a half, we are not experts.
We're just family.
So we'll take our promo break here, and when we come back, actually not, and when we come back,
we'll talk some more about Barbara Gordon
mm-hmm.
and other, or not. We were just going to talk about art.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about how Dr. Bill is addicted to Diet Mountain Dew, and Shag's getting his period. I don't know. It's something, it's a... That was always the very special episode of Blossom.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in the Tumblr world, these two guys, when they... In fanfic, right? I should say that.
Well, yes. Well, when the two of them team up together, there actually is a name for it, and it is amazing.
What is it?
The Dumpster Bros.
Well, yes.
They both spend a lot of their time getting thrown into dumpsters. Because...
Let me interrupt just for a second before we get to that.
Yes.
I want to say, we understand we're talking about physical disabilities. Is that important? To talk about mental and emotional disabilities?
It's actually the other reason that Bucky gets thrown in.
True.
Because...
Right. He's a little damaged.
Because then you've got PTSD.
Right.
As the...
Because there are plenty of heroes with emotional issues.
Mm-hmm.
And addiction issues and other things. I didn't know if we should say at this point, we're talking about physical disabilities. And we can even throw out a pitch to the Arkham Sessions if you want to talk about mental and emotional disabilities.
Yeah, if you want to talk about... Yeah. Maybe make a little shout-out here. We can just
and then
edit it back earlier.